Welcome to Talking Precision Medicine, the podcast in which we discuss the future of healthcare and health technology and how advances in data and data science are fueling the next industrial revolution. In this episode, Genialis CEO Rafael Rosengarten sits down with Ajay Gopal, CEO and founder of RX Studio. RX Studio is a technology company using data science to tackle a major limitation to personalized medicine, drug dosing. Come on in and have a listen.
It is my pleasure to welcome our guest today, Ajay Gopal. He is the CEO and co-founder at RX Studio. RX Studio is a data-driven biotech, although I'll let Ajay describe to us how he likes to characterize it, working on precision medicine, working on building models that can be used to guide dosing and other therapeutic decisions. But Ajay, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the company? You know, what is the problem you're trying to solve? What's your mission and vision? How do you get into it?
Yeah, and Rafael, first, thanks for having me and RX Studio on your show. Really appreciate that. And congratulations on your recent funding. Really looking forward to what you do with that. I'm the CEO and co-founder of RX Studio. We've been around for about 2.5 years. We started in autumn of 2020, inspired by COVID and antibiotic shortages. And really, my role has shifted recently in my career from heading data science teams to kind of leading the vision for this company. That's very personal to me. And I'll refine what you said, Rafael. RX Studio, we think of ourselves as a health technology company, not necessarily biotech in the sense that we're developing molecules and therapeutics. And what we're trying to do is fundamentally change the scale at which therapies or medication therapies are being personalized. And I'll get down to why. So our big picture vision is the future world we want to live in is one where most of my interactions with my physician and my care providers is preventative in nature. And if I do have to have some kind of intervention that is hyper-personalized to me, it is aware of my context, my lineage, and my family problems, and my genetics, and all of that. And I think that's kind of the overarching goal that we're shooting towards. And our piece in that puzzle is to first identify that we have an inefficient system in terms of how medication is handled, at least in the U.S., and that there's a massive opportunity to optimize through personalization. And I can characterize this in a couple of ways. I think the financial argument makes immediate sense. As a country, there are something like 4.4 billion prescriptions fulfilled every year, and a bulk of them are suboptimal. And it's fewer than 10 for me, so it's way more than 10 for a lot of other people. Now, fundamentally, these are inefficient, and a lot of them happen in a hospital and clinical environment, and a lot of it happens in kind of the retail space, and refills are a good chunk of them. And our fundamental thesis is that any time a prescription is written or it is renewed, there's an opportunity to ask, is it still optimal for the patient? That's at the heart of what we're trying to do. So we build a technology platform that can ask and answer that question. And we're building applications that are directed towards different stakeholders in our healthcare system to generate the opportunity to optimize. So that's how we characterize ourselves. We're building tools to maximize the efficacy and the safety of drugs powered by personalization of individual intervention events.
Got it. And then is the question more trying to pick the right drug for the patient, or is it given that you've got a prescription or a drug identified, how do we dose it appropriately? How do we make sure you're getting the right bioavailability or coverage, et cetera?
We're starting more towards the latter, but I'll tell you why that's still a pretty large problem. You know, if you tease out the economic problem, I like to think of it more in terms of risk, right? Let's ask, what is the risk that if I take this pill of Zyrtec, which I'm taking right now because of my poison oak infection, it is going to have the intended effect on me? And there's such a high variance in interpersonal response or subjectivity in response that the systems we have put into place in terms of how drugs get to market are at tension with this high variance of response. From a care provision perspective, the maximum risk is generated actually when a drug is taken to market, because clinical trials have a few hundred people at most. dosing recommendations for the drug have to, in theory, provide for 7 billion people, and there's massive orders of magnitude of variants that are not accounted for. So that is a structural problem. And what we're trying to do is progressively increase the amount of information or scale information available and fine-grain the dosing guidance, potentially with aftermarket models and population data, in order to start every individual at a slightly better pace than what it was initially thought. And that's kind of the thesis. And in terms of odds, you know, how I think about the prescription event itself, you know, there's massive amounts of energy and resources spent on the diagnosis side and developing new therapies that have modalities of action for certain diseases and so on. But after all that effort, when you receive a prescription as a patient, that is a thesis of how your treatment is likely to go. Right. Now, if you talk to leaders of lots of pharmas in private, they will tell you that the default efficacy of a drug as prescribed on a label is like 40 to 50%. That means when you get a prescription, it's a coin toss, whether it's going to work for you or not. And I think despite all that effort, we are at a point where we're still receiving a prescription that's a coin toss. And what we're trying to do is ask, hey, can we make that, you know, 40% odds and 80% odds of working for you? That's where we think that prescriptions, no matter how much effort is spent on them, are only taking the treatment half the way there. And there's a massive gap in marketing, you know, pulling ball through to the end zone in a sense.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a really huge problem. In fact, I mean, it's not hard to imagine that there's a huge amount of optimization. So two questions to follow up on that. The first one is, Are there therapeutic areas or drugs in particular that you're starting out with, right? Sort of what's your beachhead, recognizing that this could scale? And the other thing that jumps out at me is, what are the kinds of data you're able to use to understand what an optimal dose might be or what the bioavailability is on a particular patient? You know, is that coming from blood work? Is that coming from wearables, et cetera?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about wearables, but let me address where we're starting. We have started where the risks are maximum in a clinical environment, typically acute care and critical care. That's where a lot of our initial attention has come from. And because we started during COVID, a lot of that initial attention was focused on infectious diseases of the kind that our drug classes, for example, are ones that you would use for pneumonia for obvious reasons. So that's where we started from the drug class perspective. And we have expanded by incoming demand to other classes, you know, anti-seizure medicines. We have anti-metabolites for cancer therapies. We have immunosuppressants that could be for RA, or they could be for post-transplant or organ transplant type of scenarios. So we're kind of growing organically based on where the needs are clinically. But your point about where do we take this, I think fundamentally, we have a divergent information problem. What I mean by that is researchers around the world are constantly discovering more covariates that affect the dosing decision. And so I can't have enough developers and enough data scientists and researchers in my lifetime to solve for this at scale. So the approach we're taking is kind of stepping back and saying, hey, there's decades of information out there and models out there. How about we curate them and kind of generate a marketplace almost like DoorDash has done in terms of different kinds of foods that are being ordered a la carte. So we're focusing more on the clinician and the decision experience and saying, how do I make the maximum amount of choice available to the clinician in a marketplace of models that they can layer on depending on the patient and what the patient is presenting, and really make sure that taking the ball through analogy, as far as the patient is concerned, in terms of feedback loops, is really effortless, both from the clinician perspective and the patient perspective. So from a data perspective, what that means is we've launched with EHR integrated applications. So we're your typical big name suspects we are integrated with. And it being in a clinical environment affords us ready-made feedback loops because, yes, a patient is hospitalized. There's blood work. Blood work goes back into the EHR, and we can update our dosing recommendations and flag it if there's a need for a change in regimen. And ultimately, though, for this to happen at scale, at the scale we're imagining, it's hard to do this without talking to the patient at home, because care will move out of the clinic towards the home and get more distributed over.
So with the EHR integration, your customer, though, is actually the clinician or the healthcare provider. Is that correct?
That's our initial market thesis, yes. So we are building applications for clinicians or making the prescription decision or the update decision, yes. There's a world where the same technology could scale to our personal decisions on over-the-counter medications or our caffeine use or any other type of recreational use, but...
Don't tell me to use less caffeine. I love my caffeine.
But the beauty of it is the fundamental underpinnings of the models in terms of how things enter our body, they distribute and leave our body, and how that affects biological perception or therapeutic impact. Those mechanisms are the same no matter what we put into the body. So this is a generally scalable way to achieve personalization in the clinic and outside.
Well, let's talk about the models themselves a little bit.
Sure.
For those listeners who are not super into modeling and geeking out on this, well, I don't know what you're doing listening to this podcast, but we're going to go deep for a second. So tell me, first of all, you know, within the world of biomarkers, because ultimately you're looking for biomarkers of, you know, response or dosage or whatever. What are the class of biomarkers you're working with? Genialis builds what we call predictive biomarkers, right? We're trying to predict outcome of cancer interventions primarily. What are the kinds of biomarker models you guys are building?
So we're not building biomarkers, just to be clear. What we're doing is generating the opportunity to adapt a therapy to biomarkers. The thesis is there's some drug, if you're in the clinic, in an IV administration scenario that is put into your blood, and that there's a certain expectation of that drug being in your blood, and we're able to forecast it, and then a clinical blood draw is able to validate that. Now, what are the covariates or the factors that affect that transient of blood in your body? And those covariates are determined on a per drug basis through scale models. Typically, after a drug goes to market, over many years of collection of clinical data, and then they're published at scale population model. Now, what those population models establish is, hey, I have this drug, you know, it could be for IV administration or oral administration, but let's say there are six covariates. It could be your BMI, the amount of albumin in your body, your renal clearance rate, and a few other things. So these population models kind of segment the individual into six-dimensional space, identify which cell you belong to, and then say, based on this, our starting thesis of where you should, optimality is for you is a certain place, right? Mm-hmm. So when a patient initially presents, you have a cold start problem, you have no feedback loops with the patient, and that's the basis of how you start your dosing. Now, if you want to get a bit more statistical, there's asymmetry around all the covariates and the priors. So it is not just enough to look at a cell in a six-dimensional space and say, therefore, this is your fixed starting point. What the clinician needs to know is the asymmetry around that treatment, right? What if there was, 15-minute delay in a measurement time, or, somebody's height was off by 10% or something like that. So the variances in the measurement that go into the six-dimensional space will represent an asymmetric outcome in terms of the forecasted amount of the drug in a patient's body. And that asymmetry is important in the decision, and that's something we provide. Sorry, what was your point?
Just if I could interrupt, I would argue you are developing biomarker models. They're just aggregator models that are looking at what you're calling covariates, I would argue, are biomarkers. And so you're building a much more sophisticated algorithm.
Okay, well, I yield to that. Yeah, so in that sense, and we have the luxury in many cases that of clinicians already having developed these models, and we are able to take open access information and make those models available globally. And at least the cold start part of it, where the initial dose has to be decided, you don't need PHI or personal health information for that. And we've kind of made that free globally. Anyone can go to RX Studio and utilize those. Now, the second part of it is where it gets really interesting, which is if we have a feedback loop from the patient themselves. Then we transition from a more educated guess on where to start your dosing, actually being able to normalize out all the other covariates because I know how you respond, right? A single point of your personal response information is able to normalize out for a lot of other variables. And that feedback loop allows us to forecast, you know, basically identify your personal parameters, almost like numbers that travel with you for multiple weeks, they don't change, like your hemoglobin levels, right? We can establish your individual parameters that are your personal truth, at least for the next few weeks. And they're very able to forecast blood levels and therefore kind of therapeutic effects in your body. In terms of the actual markers in feedback loops, if it's a small molecule, it might be measurable directly in your blood and you can measure, hey, how much vancomycin is still in your blood. For other cases, one of your covariates could be disease progression itself. One thing that has come to attention, for example, is we have rampant drug-resistant bacteria right now. I heard of a recent case this morning where the drugs of last resort, like colistin, are not working on a new set of bacteria. Now, that has happened because over multiple years, we have been abusing antibiotics, and this has become a social scale problem, right? And so a lot of attention now is going to, hey, how do I know when to stop therapy in an optimal way? And for me to decide that, I need biomarkers for disease progression. And I think what we don't have enough yet is enough of disease progression biomarkers.
Got it. So tell me a little bit, without giving away the secret sauce, what is Rx Studio doing that's so empowering? Is it bringing the relevant information to the front or to putting it at the fingertips of the clinicians? Are you training, for example, machine learning models to, or maybe even, more traditional multivariate statistical models to kind of produce new insights? So what is the real special differentiator here?
Let me address that in maybe two or three points.
Sure.
I think the biggest gap or the unmet need in the market we see is bringing existing research, the most current research, to the clinical decision.
Absolutely.
Fortunately, unfortunately, we've talked to hospitals all around, and there's a massive disparity in terms of the standard of care. There are parts of the world that you would think are developing countries, but very advanced in terms of the thinking and precision dosing. Other parts of the world, ironically, that feel very advanced, where physicians kind of make up dosing in their head. There's no standard of care even. Our utility in that ecosystem is really, making sure all the decades of information and models are available at the fingertips of a decision maker that is sitting in front of the patient at the bedside or in a clinic. So that's our number one value proposition. And then I think part of that is for us to generate a marketplace for those models where future research gets published as soon as it is discovered. Right. It should be as simple as pushing to GitHub and making it available globally. So I think that is one part of the utility, which is clinician ease and access. The second part of it is providing the data connectivity for true personalization with input from the patient continuously. If you look at the US, we have 96%+ of adoption rate in EHRs and electronic health records and clinics and hospitals, but by policy, any patient-reported information is not allowed back into the EHR in over 90% of hospitals. Even the most forward-thinking hospitals will not allow that because they're worried about the corruption of data. So there's this wall that needs to break for us to truly personalize the therapy. And I think at least for the next few years, we will act as that bridge where we are collating EHR data with patient-reported data in order to generate efficient feedback loops for both outpatient and inpatient data. So I think that's kind of the second utility. I think if you think really far ahead from a differentiation perspective, we are global by design and intent. We are available in multiple languages. And what we are able to do is, through proxies of outcomes, generate information about the variance in outcomes globally. It could be the same drug and used in multiple geographies. And we're sensitized now to what is the dynamic range of response of a drug, maybe the same dose for the same demographic, like body types or something like that. And knowing that dynamic response actually over time generates enough data for us to build predictive tools. for our new drug. That's an aspiration of ours. The end game here would really be helping drugs go to market, generating real-world scaled evidence, and building predictive tools on top of that.
Got it. I mean, I think it's super ambitious to plan on kind of rolling out multiple geographies, but in another sense, it makes sense because you do get to see this diversity of response. It occurs to me that some geographies may also have maybe less strict or less sort of troublesome, you know, rules about what you're able to do to integrate with certain data sources. So maybe you can kind of test your functionality more instead of just beating your head against hospital regulation. But maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know.
You're right. In certain geographies, health data goes on WhatsApp.
Right.
You know, in other geographies, that infrastructure doesn't exist, and most of that information comes by through questionnaires and on paper.
We had our first kid in Texas and our second kid in California, and we couldn't figure out how to get the health information from one state to another.
Oh my!
Right? So, I would welcome WhatsApp.
Let's hold that thought because I feel very strongly about how that information needs to travel. But I'll get to that because that. Up a Nora's box, if you will. Now, so in terms of access to data, for every drug, we know what the minimum number of covariates that are sensitive are. At least if that can be manually entered, then our standalone application that we have on our website is generally usable globally as long as the language is fit, right? So the disparity in EHR adoption is actually simplifying things a little bit for us because our standalone application works globally right now. I think where access to data cannot be supplemented manually, that's where we might run into problems. But in situations like that, if people are thinking about precision dosing, I'm pretty sure we can find some proxies and some additional factors to throw in. Some of the challenges from a data access perspective might also be technical and regulatory, honestly. But anything that's technical and regulatory fundamentally has a workaround. It's a technology overhead most of the time, or a profit overhead.
Something I'd be absolutely fascinated to learn from you all in like a year or two, once you've got really deep penetration, is to what extent you're seeing sex-based disparities in the way dosing should be done. And you know, this is on my mind. I published something on LinkedIn a while ago about a book called Invisible Women about data gaps based on sex and gender. And it occurs to me that probably most drugs have their dosing based on data from male subjects, probably, almost certainly. But it stands to reason just with the metabolic heterogeneity, that's not the right approach. And your solution could be really impactful in finding the right dosing based on, we'll call it a covariate, but you know, things as fundamental as sex.
You're right. I think there's ample evidence out there that the history of clinical trials has been biased. The way that shows up for us is even the best models with the most scale, let's say, published by the best known research group in the US, 10,000 patient study population model, may not work in Brazil, may not work in Spain, may not work in Japan, right? And I think ethnic variances, that some of which can be tracked genetically, are also a factor in this space. And for us, we will be able to tell that a reference model is inadequate for your population because ethnicity or other covariates, gender, body type being very different in geographies and so on. But from a solution provider perspective, our job is to then help the hospital that has our software localize the model in the context of the population they're getting. If you're a women's clinic, I have to be able to localize the model in the context of your clinic. And I think that is really kind of the value add we bring to the table. We have these external reference-based models, but for example, a big hospital in the US might have a referral from that local nursing home, and they are exposed to geriatric population more than, let's say, another neighboring hospital. And optimizing to local hospital populations is ultimately what will be needed in order to do this right from a care provision perspective. Again, I go back to the point that from a modeling perspective, this is a divergent problem because ultimately you have to work less than more.
I hate to keep doing this, but a couple questions to follow up.
Yeah.
I'm curious to understand sort of what the big technological challenges are that you're solving. It sounds to me like it could be come in a few flavors, possibly sort of just building the APIs necessary to integrate with healthcare systems and to make sense of that. Maybe there's an opportunity for like natural language processing to be helpful, but also then, you know, building your models on the input data to aggregate those into some meaningful recommendation. But maybe I'm off base. So the first question is just, what are the technology things you're doing that are cool? And I know you do have a technical co-founder. I'd love you to talk a little bit about your team, you're building, you're looking forward to doing, not just as a business, but as a company.
Sure. Thank you. This is where I will geek out and enjoy myself. I come from a data science background in building credit risk models, and talking about the modeling is fun, and my co-founder and I enjoy it. So, okay, what is our utility or the widget that we're making in business school parlance? We are able to gather the context of an individual, match that to existing population models, make a recommendation of population model, and then under the hood, run Monte Carlo simulations in order to generate in silico patients like the individual, 2,000 to hundreds of thousands as the drug might, which takes into account all the asymmetries and the covariates and says, okay, this is the most likely trajectory of this individual's response to the first dose, right? So for all that computation to happen under the hood and in a few seconds, as the physician is pulling up a patient record, I think that is widget number one. Now, the second part of it is automatically being aware of updates in feedback loops from the patient, which then informs our Monte Carlo algorithms or simulations and populates priors and generates adaptive dosing. I think that is kind of the second widget. And that's what we bring to the table. It's really the power of cloud, high-performance computing, on top of the collation and recommendation of the proper models for the patient context. And we want to scale that. We want to scale that to every decision. So that's how I would describe the technology. From a modeling perspective, I think, you know, generative AI is cool. In my view, MCMC, Markov chain, Monte Carlo, which is like, you know, you have a Y, compute all the paths which are access to that Y, was kind of old school generative models in my mind. And I think there's a possibility to evolve that even further. And I think I lean on my co-founder for that. My co-founder is somebody I met during my kind of act two in building risk models in financial services. He's a pretty well-known figure in the R and statistical programming community, Gerde. And we're really looking technologically at how to scale this computation, make it accessible faster, and also implement the types of predictive tools that I shared with you a bit earlier today. I think as we scale the real-world evidence in terms of which models are used for which ailments, what are the responses and the outcomes on the patient side, and what are the behavioral patterns we see for the patient around that, we'll start building those predictive tools.
I have two more sort of technology questions before maybe we wrap up with some personal thoughts. The first one is, if you're doing a lot of this on the cloud, have you run into resistance or skepticism or just policy hurdles dealing with hospitals and cloud compute? Do you find that they're forward thinking about that, or do they want everything to sit in a refrigerated closet on-prem?
I mean, maybe because of our age and our being in the ecosystem for only the last couple of years, we've not run into problems where we have to be on-prem. Because we are global in scope, we do run into problems around data residency. For example, patient data cannot leave a certain country, although our computations have to be done where the computations are more efficient. We've been able to navigate those types of problems through, good practices that we've learned in the financial services, like tokenization of sensitive data, so that the primary data can be resident in the geography where it needs to be for compliance and so on. So the other types of problems we run into, I wouldn't say problems, but definitely overheads, is in different geographies, the burden of privacy and data deletion at the behest of the patient or the consumer is different. Good example is, in the US, if you're a California resident, you can go to any website, ask for your data to be deleted, and it's initiated right by the consumer and acted upon with certain SLAs by the companies and kind of the network of information. Whereas in other geographies, for example, in Brazil, it's actually the service provider's job to constantly ask every month to our, let's say, hospital partner, was there any other request? Was there? So it generates like process overheads that need to be contextualized to the geography. I think other than that, being in the cloud and the fact that we can actually access cloud localizations and availability zones that are within the compliance regions actually helps.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so that was the first one. The second question, and you warned me that I would ask this, and I didn't plan on so we started talking, is about LLMs, large language models. So the idea here, I guess, is that with everyone being somewhat familiar with these now through ChatGPT and you know, all the big tech companies trying to roll out their own version of these sort of chatbots that have, you know, deep language models behind them. These things are probably not going to have our personal health records, right? But they may have access to, say, all the published records of drugs and drug trials. And so presumably one day a doctor could say, chatbot, what is the right dosing for a patient with the following symptoms? What's your take on that? Is that a future you welcome? Is that something that's too far-fetched? I mean, there are a lot of lower hanging fruit for in the meantime, but.
Yeah, so I've actually been thinking a lot about that because I get the question a lot whether some technology like RXStudio is obviated by models like these, right? And I have a strong kind of statistically driven inspired thesis. So language models are trained on corpuses, I don't know if that's the right plural, of language. They could be trained on language and notes from an EHR. But at the end of the day, when you prompt these technologies something, they return the most likely historically trained information back to you. Now, I'm going into market with the thesis that, hey, you know, we've been doing dosing wrong for decades. Now, if you're going to tell me that the prompt is going to return data trained on the last three decades of information, it's likely to be wrong.
That's a good point.
And then the problem we have in terms of the divergent load of building new models, because researchers just develop new covariates or discover new covariates, exist there as well. I think fundamentally, these types of models will not do the creative thinking for us. They don't have the ability to do abstract or symbolic thinking and kind of generate new information that is useful for us. So my view on LLMs and, you know, both on the imaging side and the text side, the generative models, is they're likely the new user interface of convenience. There's a limit as to how much you can trust that information because it is purely statistically trained. And it is not deterministic enough to use for a medical intervention. Where we see ourselves in that ecosystem is kind of where Mathematica has gone, right? In ChatGPT, there's a Mathematica plugin. And you can say, hey, what is the integral of yada, 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 and use the Mathematica plugin. And it is going to make an API call where Mathematica has a mapping between natural language and their own internal computational symbolisms. It will do the compute and return it back to the user interface, which is ChatGPT. I think for dosing to be done right for patients, we expect to be a plugin in that ecosystem where somebody says, hey, personalize a vancomycin dose for somebody who presented with MRN, say, you know, 63-year-old female who's undergoing chemodialysis. And that should be an API call to us that returns the right recommendation. I think that's where we see this playing out. That's as far as ChatGPT and LLMs go. You brought up earlier the question around wearables and so on. Where we think we're going in that space is kind of reverting back to our big picture vision, which is I would really like to live in a world where medicine is primarily preventative. And the idea there is our behaviors, the human condition, you know, me binging out on burgers and fries for a few days, or the human condition generates incremental risk in our behaviors. And that risk is measurable. I'm going to use a friend's example here, with her permission, of course. Early in her life, during my surgery, she was diagnosed to have a genetic mutation that makes her blood clot faster than others. Mm-hmm. And she has been on blood thinners like warfarin for 15, 16 years. It's a lifelong thing for her. Now, in terms of where precision medicine and care can impact her life, you have the ecosystem of wearables that are monitoring, let's say, your blood oxygen, your heart rate variance, or a phone that can take a photo of what you're eating. The combined information there should be able to de-risk your actions that might be creating risk. So in my friend's case, if she eats too much of kale, which is high in vitamin K, her INR drop, and if she is on a fixed regimen and no adaptation, then there are large fluctuations in her clotting factors, right? Like if she is traveling somewhere and cannot have salads, suddenly the INR goes up on the existing regimen. I think where the knowledge of one's genetic risk combined with behavioral risk can identify incremental risk and have incremental de-risking strategies, that is an idealistic future that I think wearables are directing us towards. I mean, it's happening right now. Like, if my heart rate is very high, my watch says, hey, breathe for 5 minutes, right? And that's biofeedback in a sense to affect a biomarker. I'm really optimistic about that from a preventive medicine space. On the interventional side, my personal preference is to see a future that's closer to what you're doing, which is there shouldn't be any intervention I take that I can't know as a patient, you know, how long it's going to last in my body, what the intended effects are. Can I measure both the existence of the intervention as well as the outcomes? There's no reason why the therapy should not adapt to me as I'm adapting to the therapy. And I think measurability is going to be important. We're seeing the right trends, honestly. Like, if you look at the drugs approved last year by the FDA, a significant fraction of them were biopharma. And most of them, you know, 50% or more of them had some companion diagnostic or biomarker published with them. And I think that's really promising, honestly.
All right, parting thoughts, 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've already alluded to this earlier, but sort of your vision of the future that Rx Studio is going to help build.
Yeah, so medicine needs to be personal. And yeah, Rx Studio, our piece in that is interjecting that personal intelligence into every intervention decision. And hopefully, to the other point you made earlier around data portability, hopefully we see the ecosystem grow where going to a doctor's office and having my personal context available to the doctor is as easy to going to a Starbucks and tapping my phone to pay for the coffee. That if we have figured that out, where so much financial context around you and your reliability around that transaction for a $3 coffee can happen at the tap of a phone, we should be able to figure out that personalization at a doctor's office can happen at the tap of the phone. And all the related information around, hey, what is my sensitivity to this drug or that drug? And what are the biomarkers that have been good to me in the past? That my kind of medical avatar needs to travel with me in a sense. And I'm really hopeful for that.
I share your optimism for that. AJ, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me. I really do appreciate it.
Rafael, thanks so much for having us again. I really appreciate what you're doing as Virginia Hospital. I've listened to a few of your podcasts and I think I'm good.
Great. Thank you.
This has been Talking Precision Medicine. Please share the episode with your colleagues, leave a comment or a review, and stay tuned for the next one. For more information, visit genialis.com or follow Genialis on LinkedIn. Thanks for joining the conversation.